Shortly after World War II, U.S. agriculture came to that proverbial fork in the road. And it took it. Looking back to that taking of those two directions at once, we pause to ask, which direction proved best for the nation?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,197th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends who are down there in Ensenada who are tuned in as we voice on the podcast that's streaming on Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, shortly after World War II, agriculture in the United States came to a technological fork in the road. We will call one fork biology and the other fork chemistry. It also led to a transformation of agriculture, the taking of those forks. Prior to World War II, the farmer's principal investment was time, as in the farmer spends time tending to the biological growth of his soil. But after the war, the farmer's principal investment became money, as in the farmer buys equipment and chemicals to spend the time for him. So listen to how the use of money changed the family farm. This from the book Metro Farm by yours truly. When a farmer returned from World War II, he could make a good living, pay his debts, and send his children to college by farming tomatoes on 100 acres in California's Central Valley. By 1960, that farmer needed 800 acres, and by 1970, he needed 2,640 acres to maintain that same good standard of living. The taking of these two forks simultaneously led to a war of wits over which direction was best. That the soil wars continues to this day leads us to ask, why do we fight over soil? And who better to ask than Annalise Abbott, who is an agricultural journalist that one often finds in Acres USA magazine. Annalise, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here today.
Good to be here. Where is here?
Here is Otsego, Michigan.
Michigan.
So southwest Michigan, halfway between Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids.
Mm-hmm. And you are an active agriculturalist up there?
I am. I run a small vegetable CSA. I have about 8 shares, and I do everything organically.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like fun.
It is fun. I enjoy it. I like it because it's small, so it doesn't take all my time, and I can also write. So it's mm-hmm. a nice balance between the two.
Good for you. And I'll bet the people that you grow for appreciate you, too.
They do, yes. I have some really good shareholders this year.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I also find you often in Acres USA. Do you write for others as well?
I have not yet. I hope to at some point in the future.
Okay. One of my favorite magazines, and I was a great fan of Charles Walters, and now the Walters family is carrying on this incredible tradition. Now, the interesting thing about Acres USA is it's almost totally devoted to biological agriculture, correct?
Yes, I would say that, and soil health is a big theme in Acres.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I found you as the author of an article entitled The War in the Soil, Origins of the Organic Controversy. You know, as a longtime witness of this war between organic and conventional or biological and chemical, I often wondered why we fight so, and we do fight so, don't we?
Yes, and I've found that I've talked to a lot of people on both sides, and frankly, they say almost the same things. They don't really know why they're fighting. Most people, I don't think, could tell you that. They both say, well, we're feeding the world, and it's the only way to do it, and they don't even really know what the other way is.
And it was this lesson was brought home to me quite a few years ago, maybe 20 years ago, when a conventional farmer invited me to look at his organic test plot. And when I went up to the farm and he showed me his test plot, I was amazed because I reached down and grabbed a handful of soil and it ran through my fingers, kind of like the sand at a beach would. And I was struck because what he thought organic farming was just not using chemical pesticides. But that's literally one minor part of what organic or biological farming is all about. The other part, of course, is the biology is putting life into that soil. So, and yet he was so dismissive of that kind of agriculture. I just have always been amazed at the antagonism with which these two sides approach each other. And so when I saw your article, I thought, wow, here's somebody else that really picked up this subject and gave it a look. And so we're grateful to have you here today. So I have to ask you, as a writer for Acres USA, do you come down on just one side of this of the conflict?
Well, I like to consider myself, I wouldn't say like completely neutral, because I will say that I lean somewhat toward the organic side, but I also wouldn't say that I'm in full agreement with everything in all of the articles in Acres. I have an agricultural background. I have a bachelor in sustainable plant systems from Ohio State University and a minor in soil science. And so I've learned, I don't know everything by any means, but I've learned a lot about soil science, about the science that goes into agriculture. And so my personal stance at this point, and again, I don't really think that I have all the information, but is that chemical fertilizers are probably not as toxic as some of the organic people claim, but soil organic matter is extremely important, and chemical fertilizers will not work properly if you don't have soil organic matter. Now, pesticides are a completely different issue. Mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, really a good sustainable agriculture should be able to work without pesticides. So one thing that I've tried to do with this article is it's focused almost completely on fertilizers, and it doesn't really mention pesticides. I will cover pesticides in a few later articles in Acres. They should come out around the end of this year, toward the beginning of next year, because I feel like a lot of people just lump chemicals in this one broad category, like fertilizers and pesticides, and I feel like there should be a difference, because they're a very different class of chemicals. Fertilizers promote life. They make plants grow, but pesticides kill life. That word side just means to kill. So pesticides always kill things. Fertilizers, if used properly, can actually help. So I think it's important for people to distinguish between the two and approach the two topics separately, not lump them together.
Well, I think that's a great idea. And to make things simple and understandable, perhaps what we'll do is we'll take pesticides and set them aside and ignore them for the duration of this conversation and focus instead on the biology of the soil itself and life. That fair enough?
Good idea.
Okay, yep. Away we go then. So, to start, I was thinking about where do you start a conversation like this. I think a great place to start would be in the 1930s and what happened to our agriculture in the 30s is that we were practicing one kind of agriculture and we ended up with Dust Bowl days. What happened?
So what happened was American agriculture historically was not very good by any standard, by conventional or organic standards. The problem was, when the European settlers came to the United States, they said, oh, look, this whole continent, you know, they didn't really think about the Native Americans or anything. They just saw it as this empty continent with all this free land. And so their agriculture was very exploitive. They called it soil mining a lot in the 1930s. They would just clear cut the forests, plow the fields with moldboard plows, often didn't add any type of fertilizer, not even animal manure. There were exceptions, like the Dutch and the German settlers in Pennsylvania and in New York were an exception. They had some good farming. They kept their soils in good shape. But the people that were continued to move west, in general, it was the less good farmers that pushed west. The good farmers stayed on the land. The pioneers, for all their good qualities, were not very good farmers usually. And so by the time they get out to the Great Plains area, they said, oh, look, all this grass. If we can grow grass, we can grow wheat. But what they didn't realize was that grass, being a perennial crop, had really deep roots, and so it can survive a period of several dry years. because the climate out there fluctuates. Like, they'll have 5 or 6 years of rain and then 5 or 6 years of drought, just on a general recurring basis. This is nothing new. But the settlers didn't realize that, so in the wet years, they plowed up way too much land. They destroyed all that, the root system of the grass that was holding the soil in place. And so then when the dry years came, the wheat didn't grow, the soil was left bare, it began to blow in the wind, and so we had the Dust Bowl, which most people consider the worst ecological catastrophe in American history. It was quite bad. It blew dust all the way to Washington, D.C. The air was darkened off into the Atlantic Ocean. It was really bad.
And it scared the bleep out of everybody, didn't it?
It did. And that was actually what helped turn agriculture around. Because there was this man named Hugh Hammond Bennett. He was just an employee of the Bureau of Soils, but he wanted to start a soil conservation service. And so in 1933, he got temporary funding to start the Soil Erosion Service. And then in 1935, he appeared before Congress, and he timed it so that his presentation to Congress asking for funding happened to coincide with one of these really bad dust storms. And so the congressman could actually see the dust blowing in the air all the way in Washington, D.C. from Kansas, and they're like, okay, this is a problem. And so they gave him the funding, and he started the Soil Conservation Service. And then so what they began to do was they taught farmers how to keep that soil in place. And the big key was vegetation. It was increasing soil organic matter to hold the soil in place. So they told them to plant on the contour, like if you have a hill and you don't want to plant up and down the hill because then, like, rain will just wash the soil right down. You want to plant crosswise along the hill. And then sometimes they would do strip cropping, like a strip of grass. That would hold the soil in place. And then they could do row crops or soybeans or something like that in strips. And there were a whole bunch of different things. They had a lot of government propaganda they put out. There are a lot of USDA bulletins. There was actually a huge amount of information they put out to educate the public about soil conservation.
And it made an impression that lasted to this day because you can still see these techniques employed throughout the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Some of them, not all of them. Like the strip cropping, I don't see that hardly anywhere since the tractors have gotten bigger. They have trouble doing it.
Oh, good point. And the tractors have become very big, haven't they?
Yeah. The main one that people use nowadays is conservation tillage, which actually came. In fact, my most recent article in Acres that just came out this month starts talking about conservation tillage, which is kind of what the soil conservation movement morphed into in the 1970s and 80s.
Okay. And, and then into this era of the Dust Bowl steps a man named Sir Albert Howard. And we're going to pick Howard's efforts up to convince people that there was something in soil that we're missing and that we need to put it back to make things work. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, with Annalise Abbott and you. Today we're talking about the war of the soil, which was not really a war, but it was a shouting match that goes on to this day. On one side of the fence, we have people who insist that we need to build biology back into the soil. And there are all kinds of different themes that express that intent, from biodynamic to organic and so on. And the other side are the chemical folks. We call them conventional agriculture. And they're yelling at each other, and we're trying to make sense of both sides. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, when we left off, we were talking a little bit about the Dust Bowl days and how we farmed the life out of our soil, and that with no life left in the soil, nothing to hold it in place, the winds came and picked up the soil and blew it away, leaving nothing but inert soil there. That beautiful, rich topsoil that had been building forever and ever and ever just blew away in the wind. And into this milieu steps a man named Sir Albert Howard. Annalise, would you like to pick up the story? Who is this guy? And Sir Albert Howard.
All right, so Sir Albert Howard is British. He's not an American. And he spent most of his career in India, researching ways to make Indian agriculture improve it on what he called on its own lines. So at that time, most agriculturists were saying, well, their problem is they need to use more chemical fertilizers. And Howard at first said, well, you know, that's fine, but these people are poor. They can't afford chemical fertilizers. They need to use natural fertilizers. And what most English would have said was, well, then just use animal manure, because that's what they did in England. But the problem was in India, firewood was very scarce, and so they were using most of their manure for fuel, for cooking. And so if they used it all for fertilizer, then they couldn't cook their food. And so what Howard wanted to figure out was a way to make, like, vegetative wastes that are usually very high in carbon, things like cotton stalks or straw and stuff, how to make those into a good fertilizer so that you would use less of the manure so that people could still use it for cooking. And so he developed a method of composting, which he called the indoor method, named after indoor, that's I-N-D-O-R-E, was the experiment station that he founded in India. And so this method mixed together vegetative matter that was full of carbon and then a little bit of animal manure, and then he composted that to make a really good fertilizer. And so he used that to improve the soil, and he tried to teach people to do that. So that was his background. He did this in India. He left India in 1931 after his first wife died. That was a very traumatic experience for him. He moved back to England. He eventually married another woman who's actually the sister of his first wife. Her name was Louise. His first wife was Gabrielle. So with the help of Louise, then he started writing books that became the foundation of the organic farming movement. So his first one was called An Agricultural Testament. The second one, in the British version, was called Farming and Gardening for Health and Disease. The American version of that was called The Soil and Health, and that's what you'll see more often in American publications. So he published those two books, and that really started the organic movement in England. And then J.I. Rodale was instrumental in bringing these to the United States. He published them all at Rodale Press also. He printed the American versions of them. And so the book we're talking about, The War in the Soil, was actually the last book that Howard wrote. And I believe it was only published in the United States, despite the fact that he talks a lot about England, because it was published by Rodale Press in 1946, a very cheap paperback, very hard to find nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But this book is where he really started to become very antagonistic against chemical fertilizers.
Well, before we pick up that fight and Howard's efforts to change how we think, let's go back a little bit and pick up the technology in general. After the efforts of the soil conservation, we ran into World War II. And a big change in how we went about doing things with respect to just about everything, but agriculture in particular. What were some of the big changes affected by World War II there?
Well, what World War II really served as was a catalyst. So these changes were all beginning to take place. All of the groundwork was in place before the war, but because of the Depression, farmers couldn't really afford to buy bigger machinery, to buy more chemicals and all that. They were barely staying in business. What the war did was it really increased the demand for agricultural products. And so all of a sudden the farmers could produce at full capacity. They could sell everything they were producing for higher prices than they had since World War I. And so all of a sudden they had enough money to buy bigger tractors, to buy more chemicals, to buy all these things. And so that was one reason that things changed during World War II. The other was that there were a lot of inventions that were, again, catalyzed by the war, things that probably would have been invented anyways, but it really sped up the process. So DDT is one of those. It was invented in Switzerland, and again, we're not talking as much about pesticides today, but the war was what really accelerated that and made American farmers use it immediately after the war. It probably would have been, it's hard to say, but at least another 10 years before they would have used that if it hadn't been for the war. And even the fertilizers, they built a bunch of nitrogen fertilizer plants, especially like the Tennessee Valley Authority had some, and then there were others that the government made to make fixed nitrogen for munitions. And then after the war, those were privatized and started producing nitrogen for fertilizer. So the chemical companies really rose to prominence after the war. They were not really prominent before then. It was the war, like that, the economic boost that the war gave really catalyzed all that.
And prior to the war, Sir Albert Howard had developed quite a following as a biological advocate, correct?
He had. Now, in the United States, it was mostly organic gardeners that followed him. There were not a huge number of really large-scale farmers. One of the exceptions was Lewis Bromfield. He was the farmer who started Malabar Farm in Northeast Ohio, and he was influenced by Howard, but not just Howard. He was influenced by a lot of things. So he understood this importance of organic matter. A lot of the soil conservationists understood this, but they weren't necessarily opposed to fertilizers like Howard was. So the pure organic school, if you want to call it that, was mostly gardeners and small farmers in the United States at the time. It was not large-scale farmers.
Mm-hmm. Small being the kind of farm that my grandfather had, 360 acres up in Montana, irrigated acres, and he had just about every kind of animal you could possibly imagine, and there was no chemicals. It was all that kind of agriculture that predated the World War II efforts. And then all of that changed after World War II because people started farming. I talked about how people started farming with money instead of their time. And that had a huge impact on this farm size as well as how we went about doing things. But Sir Albert Howard did not like seeing what he was seeing in the development of this new kind of chemical agriculture, did he?
No, because he saw it as fragmented. He saw all the environmental problems that we still see today. He's like, well, if you separate the animals from the fields, from the crop plants, then all of a sudden you have all this manure. What are you going to do with it? And then it becomes a pollutant. And then you have to produce all these fertilizers to fertilize the crops. They run off. They pollute the water. You know, you have all of these problems that didn't exist when it was a closed cycle. What Howard really envisioned, and it never has yet come to pass, but he envisioned a closed cycle where everything was recycled, all the nutrients in sewage and garbage and all that was composted and returned to the soil. So that there was no waste.
And that was just about exactly the perfect description of the grandparents' farm. There wasn't much that they brought in, and not much went out, except some crops. But by and large, it was pretty much of a closed system.
Yes, and many of the farms, like the people that were better farmers, like your grandparents and like some of these people in Pennsylvania and stuff, especially the livestock farms, like dairy farms, they were in general a lot better than like the wheat farms in Kansas that were just growing wheat.
Right.
So there, especially in the Midwest too, there were a lot of these farms that they were growing the livestock, putting manure on the fields, and most of those farms, like you said, did not use chemicals before the war. It was only, like, pesticides were only used by fruit farmers in some regions, and fertilizers, chemical fertilizers were used some, but really did not take off until after the war.
And then Howard saw this development of essentially removing animals from the equation, and thought we're looking at big trouble. And all of those things that you mentioned, you know, the excess of manure, the manure ponds that we now see. You know, it's all come to pass. He was dead on. But people didn't want to listen to him, did they?
Well, in some cases, they didn't want to listen to him. In some cases, he kind of infuriated them and made them not want to. And then in other cases, they felt like they couldn't because of the economic changes that were taking place. They felt like they couldn't compete in the market unless they adopted all the newest technologies, unless they specialized. And that was, I think, the biggest factor after World War II. It wasn't so much that farmers were like, oh, we want to destroy the environment. Nobody would really say that. It was just they felt like they were going to lose their farm, and they had to do what they had to do to stay in business. They felt trapped.
And Earl Butz was part of that back in the 70s when he said, you have to get big or get out.
Yes, Earl Butz was part of it, and there was also Ezra Taft Benson was the Secretary of Agriculture during the Eisenhower administration, and Butz was his assistant secretary. And so it really goes back to the 50s, even before Butz was the Secretary of Agriculture. And then Butz is, of course, the most famous, you know, anti-organic person. He said he's the one who really started this myth that organic farming was doing nothing, like that farmer you were talking
right
about.
Right. Yes, to be a good organic farmer, you just do nothing. which is as far, really far from the truth as you can get. So, but at some point along the line, the two sides started yelling at each other. You mentioned Earl Butts, he being a good example of one side of the yelling match, the shouting match. But Sir Albert Howard proved to be his equal, did he not?
Oh, yes. Now, they did not actually argue with each other because Howard died a long time before Butts was saying these things, because Howard died in 1947. So they were not necessarily contemporaries, but yes, they represented opposite sides of this argument.
And how did the sides become opposite? At what point, you know, along this timeline here, did, you know, one side look at the other side and say, to hell with you, I'm going the other way, I'm taking the other fork, I'm going to have anything to do with you?
I put that at right after the war, like starting 1945, 1946, at least as far as the organic ones. And then the really strong backlash against organic agriculture was a couple years later, like the early 1950s, was when there were some really articles that were really opposed to organic agriculture. There was one that was published in Reader's Digest. Oh, it was also published in The Country Gentleman called The Organic Farming Myths, or there's one like Organic Farming Bunk. And so they're like, organic farmers are pseudoscientists, half-truths, you know, and all that. But that really started in the early 50s, that really strong anti-organic. But the organic people were lambasting, like Howard, the conventional agriculture, and especially like Howard really criticized the reductionist research system at the agricultural experiment stations. He ridiculed their pocket handkerchiefs of land, and he didn't think that the randomized replicated plots were a good way to measure agriculture.
So you're suggesting that the fight was started by Sir Albert Howard?
Well, I'm not going to say, like, completely. I'm going to say he maybe started yelling earlier, but he saw trends that didn't come to fruition for a couple more years. So I'm not going to say that he started it in that he provoked them and they would have accepted organic agriculure if he hadn't said anything. I'm not necessarily going to say that, but I'm going to say that the organic people were against chemicals before the chemical people were against organics, but only by a few years.
You talk about one of the big mistakes Howard made in his attack on conventional agriculture. What he was saying, essentially, is that, look, if you use all of these chemicals, you're going to oxidize the humus in the soil and kill all the life. All of the bacterial populations are going to die, and there's going to be nothing left to hold the soil together or to provide nutrition for the plants. One of the things that you suggested he really failed to do was not clarifying what actually was happening in the soil.
Yeah, because the thing is, chemical fertilizers in and of themselves, if used judiciously, are just nutrients. They're not going to kill bacteria and organisms. What's going to cause those populations to decline is if you don't have enough organic matter in the soil. So if farmers are just adding chemicals instead of putting back organic matter, like if they're not adding manure or growing cover crops or plowing in crop residues or something, then yes, that's going to negatively affect soil life. But it's not the chemical fertilizers themselves that do it, it's because they're not adding the organic matter. And then the chemical fertilizers will speed up the microbial decomposition of the organic matter that there is, and so it'll be oxidized, and so it will really decrease the soil organic matter. But that's actually because the life in the soil is temporarily increased. It's breaking things down faster. And so the problem is, the big problem that Howard, and then Rodale was really bad about saying that chemical fertilizers were toxic and caused cancer, and he had absolutely no evidence to prove it, and that was what really discredited the organic movement. If they would have argued, you know, look, you need organic matter, that's really important, chemical fertilizers are inadequate, that's what Howard said at first, that was valid, that was scientifically valid, but it was saying that even one drop of a chemical fertilizer is so toxic it'll kill everything. That's what really discredited them when they said things like that.
And people were listening. And a lot of people actually believed them and started yelling at, started joining in them and yelling at conventional agriculture and saying that The use of these fertilizers is killing the soil and going to kill us and going to ruin the earth. And pretty soon the conventional people looked at this and said, these folks are crazy. We have to do something.
And they that was the problem.
And that was the real beginning of the war then.
Mm-hmm. Yep. If Howard would have just stuck to promoting the benefits of organic matter and hadn't dragged in all of these kind of questionable things that weren't really backed up by science. But the problem was, by the end there, he had, you know, this really disregard for all of reductionist scientists. He just kind of dismissed everything instead of, you know, sifting through it, because there really was some good scientific research that was going on, but he just got this idea that, oh, all, you know, plot research is, you know, useless, and so he didn't really even try to look at the scientific literature after a point. He did before when he was in India, but by the end
hold
there,
that,
by the 40s.
Hold that thought, right back on the food chain.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the food chain with Michael Olson.
We are back, and we are talking about the war and the soil, the war between those who believe that we should pursue biologically intense soil and those who say, no, we just have to go with chemistry. We don't need the biology anymore. We can do it all with chemistry. And that was where we were with kind of left off. Sir Albert Howard looked at the other side and said, you're killing us. And those on the other side, the conventional folks, said, you're crazy. And that really precipitated an ongoing fight that in a lot of cases still goes on today, does it not, Annalise?
Yes, it does. And the most interesting thing is that both sides pretty much say the same things now that they did 70 years ago. It hasn't really progressed much since then.
And one of the things you make note of is that it actually got political, where one side would accuse the other side of being socialists, and the other side, you know, would yell at, you're a capitalist or something like that?
Yes, this happened in the United States especially. Now, Howard didn't have much to do with that because he had already died by then. But you can definitely see during the early Cold War, the whole idea of agribusiness, of chemical agriculture, somehow became linked with American capitalism, with freedom, and then anything that seemed to challenge that was automatically labeled communist, whether or not it really was, which the soil conservation wasn't. I mean, it was all about individual farmers, too. It wasn't communist, but it got labeled that way by people who were, for reasons I'm not 100% sure of yet, or opposed to it.
Well, we do like to call each other names, don't we?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Especially those with whom we disagree. They're always something bad. And this was a good case in point. So after Albert Howard, the conventional side of agriculture kind of shut off the organic side, saying we're not going to listen to you anymore. But somehow the organic technology crept into the agriculture community via education, correct?
Well, not until fairly recently, like not until started some in the 1970s, but really a lot of this research, like I talk about the mycorrhizae and stuff in my article, has only been really since the beginning of the 21st century.
Well,
it really wasn't until after the Cold War ended.
Let's pick up the mycorrhizae, too, because that was a one of Howard's advocacies, too. He's pointing at the mycorrhizae in the soil and say, look, this is the key. Why was it the key?
Well, mycorrhizae are a symbiotic relationship between fungi and plant roots. The word actually comes from the Greek. It means fungus root. And so what mycorrhizae do is they take the nutrients in organic matter and then they break them down and then give them to the plant so the plants can absorb them. Because plants really can't absorb most of their nutrients directly from organic matter. Now, there's some new research that's coming out saying maybe they can a little bit, but still, most of them, they need help. Either they can absorb just the simple mineral nutrients, or the mycorrhizae can get them for them. Like, they're really important, especially in phosphorus uptake, because phosphorus is immobile. It just kind of sits in the soil. It's not very soluble in water. And so the mycorrhizae greatly increase the surface area of the plant's root system so that they can reach a lot more phosphorus than the plants could just with their own roots.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that Albert Howard laid on the table and said, look at this. But there were others who were working on the mycorrhiza as well, who developed some pretty convincing truths.
Yes. The first research on mycorrhizae was done by, started a German plant pathologist named Albert Bernhard Frank, and he was back in the late 19th century. But then the plant pathologists kind of got hung up on this idea that every microorganism that was attached to a plant had to be a pathogen. So it took them a long time to realize that maybe they could be beneficial, because they were just stuck on this idea that they were pathogens. And then they also had this problem that usually the way that they isolate pathogens and that they prove that they're pathogens is this system called Koch's postulates. And in Koch's postulates, you have to be able to isolate the pathogen from an infected organism, then you have to grow it in a pure culture, then you have to inoculate a healthy organism, make it cause the disease, and then you have to isolate it again. But you can't use that kind of research technique with mycorrhizae, because they're what's called an obligate biotroph, which means that they can't live without their plant host. They die. They can't grow in a petri dish by themselves. They can only grow on plant roots. And that's why mycorrhizal research really didn't take off until more recently. They've come up with different methods that they can actually study mycorrhizae better, but for a long time, like, they can't grow it in a pure culture, so they weren't really able to study it, and so they thought that what they didn't know was not important, and that was kind of the take that a lot of conventional agriculturists took, was like, well, we don't really know about it, therefore it must not matter.
Mm-hmm. It's not unlike how we see all of the microorganisms that live within our bodies.
Yeah, I think they're just now starting to realize the importance of those.
And so Albert Howard put this mycorrhiza on the table and said, look at this. People started doing experiments. I think of the one with the Scots pine being a good example. Would you explain that one?
Yeah, so this one was a plant pathologist called Mabel Rayner, and I wasn't really able to find a lot of biographical information about her, but she published this research in a book called Problems in Tree Nutrition, and so there was this soil in a certain part of England called the Wareham soil, and the soil just didn't grow good trees. Like, there was something in the soil that made the trees not grow, and they eventually discovered it was something related to, like, bacteria in the soil. But they discovered that if the trees were fertilized with compost, then they would grow really well, and then they realized it was because then they had their mycorrhizae, because pine trees don't really grow at all without their mycorrhizae. Most trees, like, need them. Like, they can't grow just in a sterile medium. They need that mycorrhizae to be healthy. And so she discovered that if you put the compost on the trees, they grew much better, and they were much healthier. They could actually grow trees in the soil that wouldn't even grow trees without the mycorrhizae.
And thus, Albert Howard's living bridge really became a significant thing. When did conventional agriculture start picking up this notion that there may be something to what he's saying?
Like I said, I think they started doing mycorrhizal research again in the 1970s. One of the articles I read said that it wasn't really considered real science until then, but really this is like a really hot topic in research now. It really has taken off since the beginning of the 21st century. So it's really only been in the past 20 to 30 years that conventional agriculture is really accepting the importance of mycorrhizae.
Wow. And it is important, too. You write that, we now know that the mycorrhizae increase the root absorption of a plant by 40 times?
Yes.
A huge, huge change, if you could make money on that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that conventional agriculture starts looking at this. So we come to a point where, well, maybe those folks on the other side aren't so crazy after all. Are we actually starting to talk these days instead of yell, or are we still yelling at each other?
Well, it depends on who it is. If you say the word organic, then they'll probably still yell. But if you approach it more as soil biology and talk about mycorrhizae, and you approach it using the scientific terminology, the more foresighted conventional farmers are beginning to care about this. There's, of course, still a lot of old-school farmers who, not necessarily all old. I've met young people who are like this, too, who are still just like, you know, chemical everything. But there are an increasing number of conventional farmers, and there's an increasing number of agricultural scientists who are saying, okay, well, now this is scientifically acceptable. It's been published. You know, there's been thousands and thousands and thousands of scientific journal articles published on mycorrhizae by a credible scientist. So now we're really starting to look at this and say, yes, this is important. What can we do to encourage mycorrhizae in our crops?
And as we learn more and more and more, we end up with a situation with which we know we don't know a lot when it gets right down to it.
Yes, and I think at least more progressive scientists are really starting to be more honest about that. Because in the early 1950s, right after World War II, there was this idea that we could actually learn everything about the world, that we could not only learn everything about how the universe works, but we could actually, you know, change it and make it fit our needs better and control it all. And I think now we're starting to realize that, oh, it's a lot more complicated than we thought. Maybe we can't really figure it all out. Maybe we can't really recreate it because it's so much more complicated than we thought at first. So maybe there's something to the idea of working the way it's supposed to work, because maybe that's the only way we're ever really going to be able to do it.
And, you know, with respect to the essential nutrients a plant needs, you know, we look at it and say, well, there's 16 that plants need, we know for sure. But, you know, there's been many more that have been identified in plant tissue. So we talk about the incredible complexity of it is, how does one know what a plant needs when it needs it? That essential problem is almost impossible to answer. And what chemical fertilizers do is that they provide those nutrients directly to the plant. What biological soils do is they try to make available all of the nutrients all the time. And thus, that seems to me an essential part of the conflict, too, is you can use the synthetic or chemical fertilizers to boost things, but you really need that good solid soil to keep things going through tough times when you don't know what the plant actually needs. So, having looked at this, Annalise Abbott, do you see a place at which the two sides can stop fighting and just get along?
I really think we're getting a lot closer to that point than we have been since World War II. I think it's really encouraging that plant pathologists are studying mycorrhizae now instead of just saying, oh, everything's caused by pathogens spraying with chemicals. You know, they're really looking at this. So I think there is a lot of hope. I'm hoping that now we're finally starting to turn the corner and we're going to really start to bring biology back into agriculture. So I really am optimistic about it. I really feel like it's definitely starting to change. There's a lot of distance to go still. You know, we're not there yet, but I feel like it's starting.
What do you see as the biggest obstacles to making this transition?
The biggest obstacle, one of the biggest obstacles is this ongoing conflict, to be honest, because the conventional farmers have been told for so many years that organic is bad that they don't even want to consider even looking at what organic agriculture really is, you know, and that they might have some ideas. And then again, the organics are so anti-chemical that they are not even going to accept anything as better than going all the way. Like, Howard got mad, some of the agricultural chemists were saying, okay, yeah, we need humus. Humus is great. We can have humus and chemicals. And he's like, oh, no, they're trying to seek shelter in our humus, bomb-proof shelter. We must evict these unwelcome intruders. And instead of saying, hey, that's great, you're starting to, you know, come along. Maybe if we keep working on them, they'll come all the way over. And so I think that it's important for both sides to, you know, be more understanding of the other side, to, you know, for organic farmers to be happy that conventional farmers are using less pesticides, that the pesticides are less toxic, that they're actually starting to use less of the fertilizers, they're starting to, you know, be more careful about when they apply them, they're starting to understand that it's important to increase soil organic matter, and I think we should applaud that instead of just saying, oh, well, they're still using some chemicals, therefore they're bad. We just need to kind of, you know, be glad that they're doing at least something and encourage that so that they move farther toward a sustainable system.
When you run across a farmer who's adamantly opposed to biological soil systems, to organic farming, how do you address him or her?
Well, to be honest, it's hard to, because when people have these strong beliefs, it's really hard to change them. Like, I took a class in persuasive communication when I was in college, and we learned that for people who have very strong beliefs one way or the other, really nothing you say is going to persuade them. The people you target are those in the middle who, you know, are not really sure what they believe. Those are the people you target. Those are the ones you influence, because the ones who have really, really strong beliefs, you're just wasting your time to talk to them. They're not going to change.
It sounds like politics 1A, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of like that.
So, and yet it always helps, you know, to be able to talk to people. I, you know, became a good friends with my farmer who showed me how ridiculous organic agriculture is. And, you know, his industry has really changed. It's pretty much half and half now. It's half conventional and half organic. But I also think that the organic world has really been, you know, subsumed by the conventional world as well. And but that's another subject, I guess, down the line. So where do we go from here, Annalise?
We go from here? Well, I feel like we need to, you know, encourage all farmers to think about soil biology. We need to, you know, like I said, we need to really encourage the people. We need to applaud people for actually doing things. We need to support farmers that are using better practices. If we can't, you know, supporting organic farmers is really important. If there's something that we can't find organically, we should try to find the farmers who are using better practices and support them, so that, because really, the reason that more conventional farmers are transitioning to organic is because of the market. So if the market, you know, says, oh, you know, people want organic produce, then I've met people who actually, you know, transitioned just because, oh, well, you know, and then they discovered that it actually, their soil was healthier. Like, I actually visited a dairy farm just a month or so ago, and he used to be conventional, and he transitioned to organic mostly just to save the family farm.
There you go.
Same business.
Well, out of time, Annalise Abbott. Check her out in Acres USA, Annalise Abbott. Thank you so much for joining us, Annalise. And folks, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.